Welcome to We've Got Issues. I'm Joshua Holland. This week, we're going to do a double segment with Dave Karp. Dave is a professor of communications and public affairs at George Washington University. He's also a smart, funny guy who is always a good guest. Happy to have him. First, just a couple of items you may have missed. The insanity in Florida continues apace. And, we really have to do a whole thing on that, I think. Another whole thing on this. With Democrats largely sidelined, the flood of really crazy bills keeps growing, along with Governor Ron DeSantis's presidential aspirations. These things are obviously connected. By the way, DeSantis isn't going to beat Trump in a Republican primary, right? So all of these crazy bills are coming down the pike, and he's encouraging them, and he's, you know, trolling everybody, and he thinks it's going to give him the upper hand in a GOP primary. It's not. The dude has a glass jaw. He's also just a very weird guy with no charisma, right? I mean, like the thing, and I've made this point before, like Trump has a certain dirtbag charm. This guy does not. He also has like this allergic reaction to any unscripted human interactions. Everything has to be perfectly, you know, orchestrated with him. Everything is prearranged. And that is not conducive to the kind of retail politics that that is required to win over members of your own party during a primary season. You know, you have to go to Iowa, gotta eat those hot dogs, those corn dogs on a stick and all that, and deal with people. Anyway, public officials in Florida are shielded from defamation suits. They can say whatever they want about you, but Republicans introduced a bill that would abolish the state's journalism shield laws and make it much, much easier to sue media outlets. One thing the bill would do, which is interesting, is create a legal presumption that statements by anonymous sources in news reports are false. A legal presumption. And DeSantis gave a speech this week saying that they should be presumed to be malicious. And these are obviously standards for defamation. So any anonymous sourcing, and you know, I'm a critic of anonymous sourcing. I think it's abused and used way too much, but of course there is a role for it. It's very important to have that be available and not to invite a frivolous defamation suit. The bill HR 991 would also lower the standard to prove actual malice, and it would also change the definition of public figure. So basically it would narrow the definition of public figure, and public figures are harder to, it is harder to prove defamation when you're reporting on a public figure than a non-public figure. And that's just one of dozens of like unhinged bills being considered by the legislature. DeSantis also wants to extend his infamous Don't Say Gay law to high school students. There's another bill under consideration that would ban any sex ed whatsoever until high school, which seems like a formula for increasing unwanted pregnancies. But Florida Republicans are going to address that problem by using the state power to force young women to carry pregnancies to term unless they terminate before 6 weeks. There are too many of these bills to list, but maybe we'll devote, like, again, a whole segment on this in the near future because they're really going hog wild down there. But speaking of Florida's infamous Don't Say Gay law, its author, former state representative Joe Harding, pleaded guilty this week to wire fraud, money laundering, and making false statements under oath after he was indicted on charges that he fraudulently obtained COVID-19 relief funds. And I think this story just kind of epitomizes the modern conservative movement, because this guy, like many of them, you know, he leaned into the culture wars and he used them as cover, and he's a grifter. In this case, Harding stole $150,000 in COVID relief funds, which he pocketed. And, he had railed against the entire mitigation strategy for COVID, including supports for others, you know, while he was just putting all this money in his pocket. And now he faces up to 35 years in federal prison. Although, you know, that's a maximum sentence. I doubt he'll face that. Republican Speaker of the House, Kevin McCarthy, is meeting with the mother of Ashley Babbitt, the MAGA terrorist, I guess, MAGA extremist, insurrectionist, who was killed by Capitol Police as she tried to breach an internal area where lawmakers were huddled during the insurgency of Dunces. Earlier this year, Kevin McCarthy pissed off Donald Trump and his cultists by saying that the cop who killed Babbitt was, and I quote, doing his job to protect Congress from the mob. So that meeting should be awkward, but also it's, I think, pretty revealing in terms of how quickly ostensibly mainstream Republicans, remember, like Kevin McCarthy, Tea Party favorite, you know, very conservative a few years ago, now attacked by conservatives as kind of a squishy rhino. And he has shifted, like all of the rest of them, from condemning the insurrection to really embracing the idea that they were, you know, just tourists and they're those who are being convicted are political prisoners or whatever. It's all scary stuff. And on that disturbing note, we're going to get on with the show. Stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then we'll be right back with Dave Carpenter.
Let me tell you what I'm thinking about. Let me show you what we've been fighting about. Why can't we just be friends in this love affair, my baby? We all know, but we don't say nothing. We all talk, but we don't say anything. Why can't we understand love can be a friend? I hear me. Let it pick you up when you're giving up. Love understands. It won't tell you lies, looking in your eyes. Oh, baby, hi.
Welcome back. My next guest is a very smart guy. Dave Karp is a professor of media and public affairs at George Washington University, and he writes often, but not exclusively, about the intersection between politics and technology, again, among other things. Professor Karp has a Substack newsletter, which you should go and subscribe to. I think that's my advice as your attorney. Go and subscribe to the newsletter right now. It's called The Future Now and Then, and you can find it easily enough just by Googling Dave Karp with an F, silent F at the end, Substack. It'll pop right up. Dave, welcome back to We've Got Issues.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, great. Thank you. Thanks for taking the time. The last time we had Dave on the show to talk about a specific topic, which is how we usually do things, but this time we're just going to talk to him about a couple of things he's been writing about that have caught my eye of late. Let's first talk a little bit about Elon Musk's Twitter. Some listeners may know of Dave Karp from a viral moment he had on that website before it was bought by Elon Musk. Dave called the New York Times columnist Bret Stephens a bedbug, which is a pretty benign insult in the context of social media. Dave didn't tag him, but Stephens became enraged and tried to get Dave fired. Anyway, Dave, you recently predicted that Twitter will likely go bankrupt sooner rather than later. What do you think that would look like?
So first, let me make clear what I think is going to happen. I give it about 6 months. But what I think the trigger is going to, like, we know that Twitter is not making money. It was mostly making money off of ads. Elon's strategy of pissing off all of the advertisers and inviting all the Nazis back on hasn't worked for advertising. His other strategy of just charging people for Twitter Blue and hoping that the millions will sign up for it, that hasn't worked either. He's replaced billions in ad revenue with millions in Twitter Blue funding. I'm not an economist, but I'm pretty sure that's bad.
Yes.
And since when he acquired it, that included, I think it was about $13 billion in debt financing. Every year he owes about $1.2, $1.3 million just to finance the debt.
Billion.
Billion. $1.2, $1.3 billion. So every 3 months he has to fork over about $300 mil. And the website is like that. That's not going great for the website. But what I expect the trigger is going to be is actually one of two, what I call financial time bombs that aren't so obvious when you look at their expenditures and their revenues. One of them is there's a bunch of employment lawsuits that are kind of lurking in the background. They're not picking up a lot of news right now, but they were reported when they happened. Because when he offered people severance to leave, he said, you're going to get, I think it was 3 months severance. It was then reported that he was kind of like crossing his fingers behind his back when he said that. Also, when he fired Parag Agrawal and the other executives right when he took over, even though it was within minutes of taking over Twitter, he insisted he was firing them for cause, and so he wouldn't have to pay them I think it's amongst all the executives, $100 million he owes. They're all suing, and I'm pretty sure courts are going to look at that and say, you actually need to honor your contract.
Your contract. Black and white.
Yeah, so that's going to add to the balance sheets. And bankruptcy would be a really mean way to get out of it. I'm not a bankruptcy lawyer, but that strikes me as a thing that I would not be surprised to see happen. But actually, what's probably going to happen before that, since lawsuits take a long time, we know that Twitter is under an FTC consent decree for the way it violated people's privacy, back in 2010, 2011. Twitter has not been following its consent decree. It was several months ago that one of Twitter's major lawyers posted to the company Slack, here's the whistleblower hotline. We're in violation of the consent decree. Stop trying to self-certify things. You're going to get yourselves in trouble. Bye. I'm out of here. FTC has opened an investigation on this. Those fines could be in the hundreds of millions or the billions. And he's also in violation of the Digital Services Act in the EU. They've also opened an investigation. Those investigations are eventually going to come with a price tag because, again, this seems like a pretty cut and dry issue. There's reporting he has to do, and he fired everybody who was able to do the reporting. He's just not doing it. He also, he's fired his comms team and replaced them with an autoresponder that just gives a poop emoji. Not a great way to run a business, I don't think. But I don't know exactly how long it will take for those fines to come down. I figure it's probably about 6 months because, again, these don't seem like hard investigations. And when that does, not only is that going to add, let's say around a billion, I'm guessing, but I would not be surprised by a $1 billion price tag for the fines for them demonstrably breaking the rules. That's going to be an opportunity for him to throw up his hands and say, you know what? I was about to save the global public square. I was about to fix everything. But then the regulators came in and they ruined it. They're now running us out of business because I guess they just are afraid of free speech.
Yeah.
That's going to be his hatch to blame the government and get the hell out of this losing business and get all of his VC fans, get all of his Tesla fans to have a story they can tell themselves in which Elon really was just about to save it, we swear, until that meddling government got in the way. But my guess is that's what's going to happen. Now, I think the other part of your question is, okay, if Twitter declares bankruptcy, what the hell does that actually mean?
Can I go back? Can I become active again? Yeah. Will I be able to go back?
Oh, yeah. I think the question, I don't know what happens when Twitter goes bankrupt. It goes up for sale. And the real question is, what is the state of the platform at that point? Has a real competitor emerged? We've got Mastodon, but nothing has emerged that's near the scale of Twitter yet. People haven't moved to one place yet. But also, the actual tech stack is degrading because he fired all of the engineers. Twitter's now breaking once a week. So it depends a little on what is the state of the platform when he's ready to declare bankruptcy and give up. And is it something still worth acquiring? And there, I just don't know, because it depends on what the next 6 months or however long it takes for the fines to come out. It depends on the trajectory of the next 6 months. We know it's a bad trajectory. But we don't know how bad. And that's going to, I think, influence what happens next and whether Twitter eventually becomes salvageable. I just don't know. It's going to be a mess.
So the question that and the unknown is will it become an old mall that has lost its anchor stores, or will it actually face flood damage?
Mm-hmm.
That makes the property itself something that you have to just condemn. A big factor here for Twitter, for its continued relevance, I guess, is the journalist, right? I mean, there was an analysis by the Toe Center for Digital Journalism, I think last week, and it found that almost no journalists have deleted their accounts, which makes sense because deleting your account is a permanent action. I have not deleted my account, even though I'm inactive. But also, they found, and they tracked data from thousands of journalists, they found that they've only decreased their tweeting by 3% on average. Right-wing publications, journalists from right-wing publications are tweeting more than they used to, while those who report for neutral or left-leaning publications tweeted a little less. What do you think it says, Dave, about the state of American journalism and also about the kind of ongoing fight to protect our democracy, flawed as it may be, that so many journalists are continuing to use the service like they did before, despite the fact that a rich troll like overpaid massively for it and then banned reporters who wrote critical stories about him, reinstated a bunch of like vile bigots and gamed the algorithm of what he calls the public square?
So there's another data point that that would matter a lot to me in that. Since Elon very helpfully decided to add view counts to all tweets, that's data that you could have fetched before, but it was hard to fetch, and now it's in all of our faces.
Yeah.
And as soon as he did that, it started to really register for me personally just how few people actually see my stuff. I've got it's 42,000 Twitter followers, mostly because of the Brett Stevens thing back in 2019. but I'm like, they've come and gone. You know, like I've had some other viral jokes since then. But you know, it's like, let's be clear, like that's where my Twitter fame comes from. But when I post a link, something I wrote on Substack. So this piece that I wrote for The Atlantic back in December, I noticed that about 2,000 people out of the 42,000 who follow me were seeing my tweets. And that's not how many like it, how many retweet it. That is how many are on the website and see it in their timeline at all. Like it gets registered into their timeline. And so what I wonder about, like it doesn't surprise me too much that journalists are still tweeting. Because, like, I still, every time I write a Substack, I post about that on Twitter, right? Like, that's part of the routine is you want to post it to social media.
Yeah.
I use Mastodon now, too, so I also post it to Mastodon. But you're always going to post your stuff to Twitter because that's part of the routine that has been built up over the years.
Yes.
What I'm curious about, I think Twitter's still probably decaying because what we really want to know is time on site. How many hours per day are people reflexively still logging onto the thing? And my guess is that's going down, particularly as they kill TweetDeck, particularly as instability goes up, particularly as it just seems to be an emptier conversation.
Yeah.
So I would actually go a little easy on journalists there because, you know, if your editor has an expectation that when something goes up on the website, of course you're going to tweet it to try to get some extra views. Like I've been hearing journalists and newsrooms say, yeah, like we're just getting a lot less traction on Twitter than we used to. It's a shame. So they've noticed that downward trend of people are hanging out on Twitter less, but you're still going to post your stuff. And journalists, most of all, since they're the ones who are creating content all the time, like, yeah, they're still going to be posting that stuff all the time. Like,
yeah,
that's auto. Like I also post, like, or actually I don't even bother to post to Facebook, but I imagine they post it to Facebook. But if they're not boomers, they're not actually using Facebook.
Right. So I kind of distinguish between promoting your work on Twitter, using it for that, and hanging out on Twitter and being snarky and posting, you know, dog pictures and stuff like that. And doing the latter without even acknowledging that there is an ethical question to that, right? You are supporting this. You are supporting Elon Musk's Getter alternative, right? Yeah. And so I have not, you know, deleted my account. I am still on Twitter. I log in once a week to promote the podcast, and I am otherwise logged out and inactive. My dog pictures and my snarky comments are posted to a much smaller audience on Mastodon and also for the moment on Counter Social and Post.News. So it's I do make a distinction between like promoting your work and just tweeting through it as if it's normal, as if everything's fine. You just like, here's a joke, you know.
So I actually make a little less of a distinction there. I think you have a moral responsibility if you're going to use Twitter to cyberbully Elon Musk at least a bit. So I still spend less time on Twitter than I used to, but I definitely like, I have two small kids. My two small kids like to watch shows on Disney Plus at the end of what is a long day for me.
And I'll tell you, the fifth time that you watch that show, you need to look at something on your phone, and it's still usually Twitter. So like Twitter's still part of my routine, because like, as the dad of young kids, like, I need something. I'll look at Mastodon too, but like, I need some stimulation that is not just Elena of Avalor, I gotta tell you.
You know what?
And I feel comfortable with that. What's that?
I'm gonna admit something. I have this, like, I have these accounts that I follow while logged out of Twitter. So I'm not an active user, but I'm checking on, there's, I think, 11 accounts, all reporters, and I check them regularly on Twitter, even though I'm not logged in. Anyway, let's move on to a bigger and perhaps more consequential story, I think, the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank, which was followed by a couple of other banks experiencing quote-unquote distress. Now, I am no expert in venture capital and all that, but it seems to me that the Fed raised interest rates in large part to cool off the labor market and stop the little people from constantly demanding higher pay. That wasn't the whole story, of course. It was also about real estate market and used cars and all that. But they've been trying to cool off the labor market, and that ended up burning the tech venture capital market. And then those stalwart libertarians demanded that the federal government intervene and bail them out. Do I have that right?
I think that's right. The added dimension there is absolutely, like, I'm also not a banks guy. I am a politics and tech guy.
Yeah.
Who has like, I read Matt Levine's newsletter so I can understand anything about banks. It's very helpful. Right. So now I can repeat back the things I read in a newsletter. But like, a thing that is striking to me is the number of banks people who, after Silicon Valley, like, as they watched the aftermath of the collapse, they were like, oh, you venture capital billionaires don't understand anything about how banks work. Like you're billionaires. How do you have no idea how banks work? Because like, it was like, it's all downstream of them raising interest rates for sure. But this is also a situation in which a dude with a newsletter published in his newsletter that Silicon Valley Bank was technically insolvent if everyone went and demanded their money back.
Not they did.
Investing in like, wasn't investing in NFTs or any of the like, wild 2021 stuff. Like, it wasn't like an FTX thing. It was strictly a matter of they invested a bunch of money in long-term treasury T-bills, and when interest rates are high, you can lose money on those if you have to cash them in right away. So like, a guy with a newsletter publishes that, and since like the 40 biggest venture capitalists all read his newsletter, they then get on a WhatsApp chain, all freak out, and then Peter Thiel decides, like, I'm going to tell everybody who I'm invested in that they have to take their money out of the bank. And then all the other ones panicked and said, like, well, then we're going to do it too. Like, they killed their own bank, the bank that had been very good to them and was, like, the bank that wanted to deal with weird startups. They destroyed that bank because they, like, got scared on a WhatsApp chain. This is not, like, these are not titans of industry who understand all of the angles and are like deeply rational.
Steely-eyed, cold
WhatsApp group.
Yeah.
And like, to me, it's like a great example of this is why when wealth gets too concentrated, when inequality is too big, everything gets messed up. Because they wouldn't have been able to destroy their bank. Like, they called in everybody they were invested in, and $42 billion left the bank in like less than a day. And most banks would end up going into receivership if all the money just walked in and said, we need to take it out right now. But that wouldn't happen to any other bank, because $42 billion usually isn't controlled by people who are in a WhatsApp group together. Like, for their own good, we should have a wealth tax, because like, the Silicon Valley of the 1990s didn't have so much concentrated wealth that it could accidentally freak out and kill its own bank.
I mean, for their own good, to protect them from themselves, but also to protect the rest of us from them.
I mean, that would be nice too.
That would be great. I mean, you know,
Elon, we're going to do you a favor and take all your money. We're going to take all your money. We're going to fund social programs.
I mean,
you'll be so much better off. We promise.
It wouldn't ruin his reputation. Look at what he's done to his his standing. There's been a big debate, largely a semantic one, over whether this was a bailout. Bailout has become a dirty word in America. Regulators announced that the FDIC would guarantee deposits that exceeded the $250,000 cap on deposit insurance. And that move was widely credited with kind of containing the fallout. Shareholders, I think it's important to point out, were not made whole. And that's kind of the classical bailout where you say, oh, we're going to make everybody whole. Dave, you seem to have kind of sided with what I think of as the sensible, less emotional side of that debate, which basically holds that it isn't a great outcome, but guaranteeing those deposits minimize the harm to the wider economy. And you also wrote, and I quote, "The collapse of Silicon Valley Bank could have reshaped the entire startup economy. It would have been a cleansing fire, and the worst people on earth would have had fire insurance." We're clearly going to need you to unpack that one for us.
Yeah, so the thing that was standing out to me as I was watching the debate over the weekend before the FDIC had stepped in, when David Sacks and Jason Calcanis were typing in all caps on Twitter, like, "This will be the end of the world." And I was joining in and making fun of those guys, because for your own mental health, like for like your well-being, you should always make fun of those guys.
Yeah,
but the thing that was standing out to me is this is a bank run that started off with Peter Thiel calling all of his investments and saying, "Get your money out." And if the FDIC hadn't stepped in, one of the immediate downstream consequences is the other startups that are the competitors to Peter Thiel's investments would not have been able to pay their employees. And I think it's entirely possible. Like, most of my research these days is I've been reading old Wired magazines chronologically to get a sense of the past 30 years of tech history. And it really just seems like had they not stepped in, there was a real chance that when we look back on the events of that week, it would have been a hinge point, a turning point, where all of Peter Thiel's investments are suddenly the winners in their categories. And his wealth and influence expands geometrically, not because he's invested in the best companies, but just because they all got their funds out and all of their competitors didn't. And since I think Peter Thiel, like, I don't think he's a super villain, but I think he's like a normal villain. Like,
I think he's pretty super.
But like the thing I want to push back on there is there's a version of looking at this that says, "My God, this was his plan. He had this planned out all along." Like, he didn't have this planned out. Dude freaked out on a WhatsApp chain. But also, since like Peter Thiel is going to Peter Thiel, like as a dyed-in-the-wool libertarian, he has no loyalty to the bank that's done right to him. So he cuts and runs before anyone else. If that's what's going to decide and determine who has power in tech, when tech is all of the biggest companies in the world, that ends up being bad for me and my politics. Like, that ends up meaning that a few years down the line, you get more J.D. Vances in the Senate. And I'd like to avoid that. So, like it's not that I don't want to see Silicon Valley change. I certainly do. But, like, this would have been a weird way for things to end for an awful lot of companies, where the problem wasn't that they had such odd business models, but just that their bank stopped existing.
And it, right.
would have been sort of a unintended and really unfortunate consequence that the worst dudes in the world, and by that I specifically mean like Peter Thiel and his buddies, would have magnified their power and influence for decades to come out of this. Like, I'm really glad we dodged that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, on the narrow issue of whether he's a villain or a supervillain, I will just point out that he, in an interview with Inc. magazine, said that he's interested in having blood transfusions from younger people to stay alive longer. So that kind of puts him in that James Bond.
Oh yeah, but like, let's be clear.
Supervillain. Like, category.
That sounds super villainy, but also that technology doesn't work, which means like he's actually just like a rich dude scared of dying, making young dudes inject their blood into him. Like, that's villains. Like, it's super villain if it really works. Otherwise, it's like he's just a dumbass like everybody else, but he has too much money and also he's a bad dude.
I mean, look, all the super villains, like elaborate plots to kill James Bond, they never worked. So I don't know. Right. I'm not sure.
That's the question.
Standard, right?
I would call him a James Bond villain and not a super villain. Because I think James Bond villains are also total dumbass.
Kind of clumsy, yeah. Fair enough. I think the people who are decrying this as a bailout, though, who are often dismissed as, you know, knee-jerk and unsophisticated, are right in one very important sense, and that is that the same people whose deposits are being covered by the government, or that social class at least, have actively lobbied for looser banking regulations, which made this incident more likely. And we know that any new regulatory tweaks that might result from this crisis will later be watered down as well. And so at some point, I feel like that position is grounded in a bunch of very recent historical memory, which I understand.
I would also add, all of the people demanding a bailout spent the past few years whining about the very idea of student loan relief and the moral hazard of it. My immediate
That's
Twitter comment, the joke that I made immediately was, like, here's the compromise: full student debt relief, and FDIC covers all of your covers everyone deposits. Like, yeah, y'all need to shut up about that. Let's have full student debt relief, and then find the money that you had on the bank on Thursday, you still have. That seems like a
totally they'll never shut up. They'll never take that
deal. They won't, because they're villains.
Right. Folks, we're going to take a quick break and then come right back with Dave Karp. Stay tuned.
That's it. The bridge is over. The bridge is over. Bye-bye. The bridge is over. The bridge is over. Hey, 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 hey. The bridge is over. The bridge is over. Bye-bye. The bridge is over. The bridge is over. You see me coming in the dance with the flipper sensei. Down with the sound called BDP. If you want to join the crew, well, you must see me. You can't sound like Shannon or the one Marley. Because Shannon, Marley, Marlon, my rhyming like the gay. Picking up the mic, man, them don't know what to say. Saying hip hop started out in Queensbridge. Saying lines like that, man, you know them countless. So tell them again, me come to tell them again. Gwah. Tell them again, me come to tell them again. Tell them again, me come to tell them again. Gwah. Tell them again, me come to tell them. Manhattan keeps on making it. Brooklyn keeps on taking it. Bronx keeps creating it. And Queens keeps on faking it.
Welcome back. Dave, you wrote a piece recently that I agreed with narrowly, but also I disagreed with in a broader sense. And I wanted to talk about that because for a couple of reasons. First, I think my disagreement applies to a lot of journalism these days, and also because it raises some questions about how to properly cover the right's endless parade of like contrived moral panics. So the post that I'm talking about was titled George Packer's Kind of Right About Equity Language Guides. Mm-hmm. George Packer, for listeners who aren't, you know, don't pay a lot of attention to this stuff, kind of made his name for himself as an ostensibly liberal interventionist who endorsed the invasion of Iraq and has since become one of those radical centrists who's obsessed with so-called cancel culture, which he portrays as a threat to like pluralistic democracy. So let's set this up by starting with where we do agree, which is Packer's basic point about a new style guide put out by the venerable Sierra Club. Give us a quick rundown of what that said and your take on it, his take on it.
Sure. And I should add a little context for listeners. I spent about, I think it was 14 years in the Sierra Club. I started off with the Sierra Student Coalition. I was their director in 1999. Spent 6 years on the Sierra Club's national board from 2004 to 2010. So I'm not so involved anymore, but like this, my teens and 20s were spent within that civic association. And I am generally a pretty harsh critic of all the people whining about cancel culture, from Bret Stephens on down the list. And so reading Packer's piece, what was striking to me is, oh God, I think he has a narrow point here. Like the broad point about cancel culture is ruining everything, I still think is silly, particularly the idea of focusing on that in the year of our Lord 2023, when there's so many worse things going on.
Yes.
But the narrow point that I saw there was the Sierra Club Equity Guide that came out in 2021 was trying to get well ahead of all changes in language to make sure that Sierra Club was using like more sensitive and responsible language. And the idea there of, hey, let's not needlessly alienate our allies is one that I fully agree with. But like some of the language they were including, they were saying things like, don't use the word empower. And like it wouldn't occur to me that empower is a problem. They said like, don't say things like stand up because that can be ableist. There was like the number of things on the list that struck me as, okay, maybe you have a point there. I had definitely never heard of that one before. And if I was in the Sierra Club, there's just an awful lot of routine language that suddenly we would all need to worry about. And the thing that stuck out to me, having spent a long time in the Sierra Club, is this thing being a guide, a guide that has come out of the organization that is going to be given to its various local and state affiliates, both staff and volunteer, trying to get everyone to actively focus on language like that can end up putting you in a situation where you stop focusing on making sure that your communications move your targets in the direction that you want them to go, or make your allies or make your opponents feel uncomfortable. And instead, it can lead you to just constantly worrying about, like, oh shit, does this offend somebody too? Does this one? So it seemed to me in particular, like the advice that at an individual level, you should think about how your language causes harm and try to do better and not offend allies. That I think is easy and correct advice.
Yeah.
But when you change scale to as an organization with thousands of voices speaking for you, let's have a style guide so that we are always avoiding all possible harms. I think that can get away from a lot of communication first principles of focus on your targets, focus on your opponents, and move towards victories. So like that's the thing that worried me. It was particularly as an old Sierra Club guide, I just like first I read his piece and then I looked at the guide and I was just like, one of the other things in it was like, don't use the word Americans. And I just found myself thinking, you know what? I really think we probably should invoke patriotic language rather than not invoking patriotic language, because I think that helps us win. Like, I think our opponents want us not to invoke that. And I would like to not, I would like our opponents to be uncomfortable, not more comfortable. So it just seemed like the type of thing which was over-focusing on, hey, watch your language, really, really always watch your language, in a way that would probably create a big organizational mess if you tried to get everyone constantly on the same page with that. So that was what I was trying to talk about in the post.
And I don't have a hard time agreeing with that. Again, I agree narrowly with both you and Packer about this. I am a Gen Xer. I am an old fart. You know, I don't say pregnant people. I say pregnant women. But nobody's ever given me a hard time for saying pregnant women, right? And I before I even get into my gripe here, I really want to emphasize to listeners that Dave Karp has no time for anti-cancel culture nonsense. He does not think that equity language guides are evidence of unhinged wokeness or represent an effort to oppress anyone or anything like that. Super clear, right? My problem, Dave, is that George Packer wrote about the Sierra Club's 2021 style guide in the Atlantic magazine, and they published it. And and he wrote about it as if it is part of a big problem. He plugged that into his narrative, which is shared by a lot of Atlantic writers, about the illiberal left policing language and infringing on free speech. And a point that I make on this show regularly is that what you choose to cover as a journalist can be just as important as how you cover it. So we've talked in a couple of weeks ago about the New York Times running 5,000 words in a 6-month period on its front page about gender affirming healthcare for minors, which is just not an issue that affects many people at all and is really not a matter of public concern. It's a private matter for like less than 1% of the population, and constantly covering it as if it's a social problem on the front page of the paper of record amplifies the, you know, frankly, fascistic propaganda about transgender people promoted by the right. And I totally get that when you write for a living, and you have to come up with topics on a regular basis, sometimes you need to like offer a take on whatever is in the news. But when I was reading your piece, I kept thinking to myself that I've worked at a number of publications and I never really gave much thought to their style guides. And Sierra Club's inclusive style guide impacts pretty much nobody. I don't believe that any activists are, I don't believe that people are going to stop saying that we need to like stand up for some principle. For example, that's an example you mentioned in your piece and Packer mentioned in his, because you shouldn't say stand up for principle because it's ableist, because not everyone can stand up, whatever. And if anybody writing for the Sierra Club decides, oh, I'm gonna use some alternate phrase to convey the idea of standing up for some principle, I don't think anybody would notice that. So I don't see why anyone should care. And I do see how this never-ending flood of commentary about obscure stuff like this does reinforce the idea that the left has lost its collective mind when it comes to language and doesn't have serious analyses of the social problems we say we want to address.
So I'm mostly with you on there. I mean, the title that I put on the Substack piece, I think it was George Packer is kind of right about this. And I was kind of, I was sort of banking in that title on the people who routinely read me on Substack knowing that I am generally on team, oh my God, how are these people still talking about cancel culture? Yeah. Stop making this a thing. Because the tone I was trying to impart with that title was, this is the one time where I think there's kind of a point here. Let's talk about this one time. Like this is a narrow case where for once, I think there's a little bit of a point, and I want to think on that a little bit. And that's particularly because while I think you're right about style guides in news organizations, in large voluntary federated organizations like the Sierra Club, again, I wasn't active with the Sierra Club in 2021, so I don't know exactly what they did do. But it is very easy for me to imagine from the 14 years I spent with the organization that when they sent out this style guide, they also would have said, all right, and we need to hold trainings for all of our federated entities to help them get up to date with this. And some of that's not a bad idea, because the Sierra Club volunteer ranks are full of retirees who often need a little bit of refresher on, like, if you're a baby boomer, you're sometimes a little confused on, like, what are the things that it's really not okay to say anymore and hasn't been okay to say for 10, 15, 20 years. Like, that's sometimes pretty useful stuff to do. But that means that I could very easily see a style guide for a federated civic association being something that actually acquires a bunch of attention and gets heavily bureaucratized.
Yeah.
And it's the bureaucratizing that worries me. Like, if this is a thing that's off to the side and nobody's reading it, then you're right. I don't care. And I don't see why anyone would care. But like I mentioned earlier in the piece, that part of why I was writing about it is because if you mention Sierra Club and strategic communication three times in a mirror, it actually summons me. Like, I will show up in your house. Because like from the ages of 17 to 30 or 16 to 30, I was on at least one Sierra Club conference call a week. Like, I knew how to run like volunteer meetings before I knew how to boil water for pasta.
Right.
Like, I was raised by and so from that sort of very narrow perspective, I found myself thinking, oh man, this seems like a thing that could have snowballed into a giant mess that leaves an advocacy organization that I really believe in through well-intentioned manner,
yeah,
putting itself at a real disadvantage. And like, that narrow point is what I wanted to get at. The broader point in terms of how the hell are we still talking so much about this? I'm 100% with you. And that is the, like the hymnal that I'm singing from all the rest of the time. So
like,
there,
how did Packer even like come across the 2021 Sierra Club style? Like, you know, somebody, somebody sent it to him and he was like, oh, let's plug this into
the Sierra Club has had. Like my actual theory there is because the Sierra Club has had a bunch of internal rumblings over the past few years that became public, particularly over a blog post that they wrote, looking back on its founder, John Muir, who founded the organization in 1892. John Muir's on the California Quarter. His history with Native Americans, his history of in a lot of his early writings, he wasn't an outright white supremacist, but he wasn't really disavowing them. And also there were a bunch of other members of the Sierra Club founding generation who were white supremacists.
Right.
So the organization did a blog post, I think in 2020 or 2021, it was probably summer 2020, because I think it was a couple months after George Floyd, where it decided to take a hard look at that. And that led to a bunch of infighting over, hey, are you throwing your, like the venerated founder from the 1890s under the bus?
Okay.
So I think it was because of that he probably looked at this and said, like, okay, the Sierra Club's had a bunch of internal wranglings. Let's look at what they're doing. And then he found this document. It was like, I mean, like, Empower really strikes me as one of like,
Yeah, that's just silly. Yeah.
Like maybe, but it's silly. Like that's where it seems like it's silly. Like, yeah,
it's silly.
Language is changing, but that hasn't changed
silly.
Yet.
Yeah, a lot of stuff does get silly. I guess the question is whether, you know, you cover the style book or how a story appears in the Atlantic about a style book and how that plays into these larger narratives. And I've made the point before that if the legacy media devoted like half of the amount of coverage to the truly unhinged like bills that Republican elected officials, people with real power, are pushing through red state legislatures and framing each of those stories as part of a larger narrative, you know, much in the same way as the Sierra Club's 2021 style guide is plugged into the narrative about cancel culture. If these stories, these individual stories of crazy legislative efforts in red states were offered as part of a larger narrative about the GOP's lurch toward really performative kind of authoritarianism, it would probably do a lot of good. Dave Karp, I believe we are about out of time. I took more time than I asked you for, so I want to thank you for offering your time today.
Sure, it was a lot of fun.
Folks, go and subscribe to Dave Karp's Substack. I would also like to thank David Edwards, our producer and engineer. I'd like to thank the good folks at Alternate and Ross Story for supporting the show. You can follow me on mastodon.social. I'm Joshua Holland. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're going to take next week off, but I hope all of you have a good couple of weeks, and we'll be back the week after that. Charleston was once the rage.
Goes on.